Welcome to Measured Impact, where we share behind-the-scenes stories of the world's leading mission-driven companies. Because when it comes to activism, brand building, and revenue growth, we believe profits and purpose aren't mutually exclusive. Let's dive in. Okay, today on Measured Impact, we are joined by Christopher Miller, SVP of Sustainability and Advocacy at AspenOne. Chris spent his career at the intersection of advocacy, climate action, and business, from working on Bernie Sanders' staff to directing Greenpeace's USA climate campaign to leading sustainability at Seventh Generation to spending more than a decade where I got to know him at Ben & Jerry's. Now he's at AspenOne talking corporate activism and social mission. So Chris, welcome. Thanks for joining us, man.
Thanks for having me, Neil. It's great to be here.
So first off, I will be transparent. I know Chris well, and so I know some of the answers to these questions, but I don't know which is the answer to this question, which is, I know who you are. Where do you currently reside, and where are you recording this from today?
So I live in Burlington, Vermont with my partner Ashley and her son and our dog and our cat in the south end of Burlington. And I am speaking to you from Hula, which is a super cool co-working space about four blocks from my house.
I believe there's some other fairly progressive brands hanging out in Hula. I think 1% for the Planet's in
1%
there.
1% for the Planet is here. That's correct. Ski the East is here. It's an incredible, the story behind this place is awesome. It used to be the world headquarters for Blodgett Pizza Oven. So they used to make pizza ovens here at Hula on this incredible campus right on the shores of Lake Champlain overlooking the Adirondacks. It's a cool building and it's an epically beautiful sort of place.
Sounds like a tough life switching back between that and the skylines of Aspen.
Half my time here in Burlington and I spend about half my time in Aspen, Colorado. Two lovely places to be.
So I know a little bit, but tell us more about what AspenOne is all about. I assume dental services, is that correct?
So AspenOne is sort of a rebranded Aspen skiing company. So just a little less than 3 years ago, the company went through a little bit of a reorganization as it began to grow and grow outside the Roaring Fork Valley of Colorado. So what was Aspen Skiing Company, four mountains in the Roaring Fork Valley, Aspen Mountain, Aspen Highlands, Buttermilk, and Snowmass, and has become a company with three separate verticals. So the skiing company, the hospitality business. So we have two hotel brands, the Little Nell and Limelight, and then Aspen Ventures, which is sort of an innovation engine for the company. So those are the three verticals. I work for AspenOne, so me and my team focused on sustainability and advocacy sit across all three verticals.
So we talked about your background a little bit already. You've worked on the political side, on the nonprofit side, and then on the mission-driven brand side. So I'm curious, what has remained consistent across those? There are obviously different executions of similar values, but what do you think is the sort of through line from Bernie Sanders to Ben & Jerry's to
Aspen? I mean, my career trajectory is unconventional for a corporate sustainability professional. As you noted, the sort of first half of my career was in policy and advocacy. I grew up in Vermont and went to college and studied political science and came out of college knowing exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to work for Bernie Sanders. I was a teenager growing up in Burlington as during his term as mayor. And I graduated from college in 1992. And I somehow landed a paid job on his first reelection campaign to the U.S. House of Representatives. So cut my sort of teeth out of college doing political policy and advocacy work, and then made the jump to Ben & Jerry's for the first time. So this was kind of late 90s prior to the acquisition by Unilever, and I worked for Ben Cohen. I worked for the founder of the company. I was an employee of the company, but I wasn't doing ice cream business. I was working for Ben on his issue advocacy work, which at that time was focused on the massively ballooning Pentagon budget, which looks tiny now compared to what it is today.
And tiny today compared to what they want for next year. So, you
correct.
Know, we're on our path.
It's a trend there. And after having spent about 5 years and about a year after Unilever bought Ben & Jerry's, I left the company and went to Greenpeace. And as you noted, led their climate change campaign in the US, and Greenpeace is a global organization. The US is their biggest office by far. And the consistent theme through that first half of my career was really focused on corporations as bad actors, right? So we're all familiar with Bernie's point of view on the world, and he's right that corporations have too much power and companies are able to buy politicians and buy policy in a way that is, I think, corrosive for civic discourse and public policy. And in Greenpeace, you know, I was getting paid to have activists hang banners off of coal plants, fossil, you know, we were fighting ExxonMobil, fighting the fossil fuel industry. And after having spent a bunch of years living in Washington, D.C., I decided it was time to come back home to Vermont. And Jeffrey Hollander, who was a co-founder of Seventh Generation, served on the Greenpeace board. And I told Jeffrey that I was interested in coming back to Vermont. And, you know, I was initially a little skeptical about joining the kind of corporate world.
Going to the bad side? Did you have some self-shame?
Turning over the dark side, what my former colleagues at Greenpeace would think of me. You know, but I was very much attracted to the idea of corporations as positive actors, sort of working within the context of a for-profit company that was trying to do business a different way. That's what Jeffrey built at Seventh Generation. And so, you know, I spent half a dozen years there sort of blending what was traditional corporate sustainability, i.e. thinking about how much post-consumer recycled content we were putting into spray cleaner bottles. But also, it's really where I began to understand the power that exists within brands to engage people on issues in a way that civil society, NGOs, I think, aren't as effective at. So we can talk a little bit more about that. But you know, then after half a dozen years, position opened up at Ben & Jerry's that was the dream job and an opportunity to return to the company had spent half a dozen years working at, had, you know, worked directly for the co-founders of the company and did 14 years there and had an incredible run there. And I think really a handful of us there built what I think is the kind of, you know, model for how a brand can create value through values. You know, I mean, the company punches so far above its weight in terms of its kind of brand, its brand awareness. You know, it is a decidedly progressive company, but it is the number one ice cream brand in the US. It sells more ice cream in Walmart than any other place. It's not a niche sort of San Francisco-based brand. And then on to Aspen One. Back to your original question, which was, what's the through line? The through line is I have consistently worked for places where I feel like are both aligned with my values and provide a platform through which I can be an agent for change. Whether that was working for Bernie or hanging banners off of coal plants, or trying to set a standard for what good corporate citizenship looks like in today's world, that's the red thread that runs through what otherwise looks like a pretty eclectic career.
I like to dive into the harder questions early. And I'm curious across those, but more specifically today, I guess, how do you manage the risk of virtue signaling being kind of core to what you're communicating, to what your team is talking about, to executives who would love to talk about the upside without being willing to, you know, engage in the risks and the potential bumps in the road? How do you think about just checking that virtue signaling? Yeah.
Well, I think the work has to be real and authentic. So the work that I led at Seventh Generation, at Ben & Jerry's, and now at Aspen One is not about selling stuff. It's about using the power of the brand and the connection it has with society, with its consumers, to sell ideas. And so I think my approach has always been that I am not the expert on the best policy to solve mass incarceration in the United States. But I know who the experts are, and the point is to follow the lead of the people that are on the front lines, that are working directly on these issues and that have been impacted by these issues, to see ourselves in the corporate world as an ally in advancing their work. I think where you run the risk of virtue signaling is when you're trying to sell stuff. So you're trying to say something or do something because you believe, I mean, it's right. It's the classic definition of cause-related marketing. It's who is my customer base? What is an issue or cause that they care about? How do I align myself with that issue or cause so that they look at me in a different way? It's deeply inauthentic. And I believe the model very much has to be rooted in not who are my consumers and what do they care about. It is, what are the values of the company that I work for? What are the things that that company believes about the world? And I'm going to tell you why we believe those things are true and engage you. And that is by definition authentic. People may disagree with positions that we took at Ben & Jerry's. My company, Aspen One, has been outspoken in its support for progressive, strong solutions to the climate crisis. I mean, it has a huge impact on our industry. And people may disagree with a position or a point of view, but you can't say that we're doing it to sell more ski passes, and you couldn't say we were doing it at Ben & Jerry's to sell more ice cream. It was real. It was rooted in a desire to use those platforms to make change and to support allies and groups and activists who are on the front lines doing the work. And I think, you know, you can smell inauthenticity a mile away. And, you know, we can talk about what happened at Bud Light or the Pepsi Kendall Jenner debacle. Like, there's a long road of failed, inauthentic virtue signaling examples. But I think that never happened at Ben & Jerry's, you know? The people who recognize Ben & Jerry's mission are just way better consumers. Like, they care about the company much more. They're much more likely to call it their favorite ice cream. They're much more likely to pay more for it. But it works because it's real.
You transfer to a new role in a new space, in a new industry, in a decidedly different activism model. How do you go about telling that story internally? You know, you talked about the idea that activism has to live separately from selling stuff. But the money for promotion and doing campaigns and doing creative often comes through selling shit, right? So how do you think about educating or bringing people along in your organization so that you can get there?
Yeah. So let me slightly correct what you, or how you paraphrase.
You don't have to slightly correct. You can correct it aggressively. It's fine.
I didn't say that you need to separate it from selling stuff. What I said was the reason for doing it isn't about selling stuff, right? And that's different because, like, if you look at the activism model at Ben & Jerry's, it's very much rooted in what the company is, an ice cream company. Sometimes it has nothing to do with ice cream, and sometimes it's an ice cream flavor, right? That's the difference. You're not designing a advocacy strategy to sell more ice cream. You're designing an advocacy strategy to win legislation that reduces emissions from the power plant sector. And you're using the same tools that you use to sell ice cream to sell the idea. And that is where the power is. Because if I reflect back to my days at Greenpeace, we were a group of very passionate activists who believed in the righteousness of what we were doing. It was righteous. It was holding people accountable for trading our future for short-term profits. And we were not like world-class marketers. The team at Ben & Jerry's, the team that you work with, the team that I work with at Aspen, they are trained world-class salespeople. The people at Ben & Jerry's somehow convince people to buy something they absolutely do not need. And they're incredible at doing it. And it is those skills that I think are the reason why brands have an opportunity to really excel at this work and to be effective. Because they do all the things, again, that you help the team at Ben & Jerry's with, right? Which is data-driven. Let's use all of the resources of this billion-dollar global multinational company to drive impact. So then your question around, you know, let's even for my new role at Aspen One, how do you build support internally or amongst leadership? I am fortunate now to have worked at three companies, Seventh Generation, Ben & Jerry's, and Aspen One. All of those companies are companies that were founded and rooted in a very clear mission and set of values, right? So that predated me joining any of these places. And so what Jeffrey Hollander knew to be true about Seventh Generation, what, you know, Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield pioneered and knew to be true about, you know, business when they started Ben & Jerry's and the founders of Aspen Skiing Company, our mission is to renew mind, body, and spirit, but not as a narcissistic exercise, but to inspire a better world. The idea that by coming to a place like Aspen, where art, culture, the outdoors sort of opens people up to new ideas and new ways of thinking. And so, you know, our mission at Aspen One is a distillation of the Aspen idea, right? That through the pursuit and enjoyment of the incredible epic beauty that is Aspen, Colorado, you leave inspired to create a world that looks more like this microcosm, right? And so I have been fortunate not to work in places where I feel like I'm beating my head against the wall trying to get people to do something that they don't see or don't want to do. People have much stronger and longer lasting relationships when they build them around a shared set of values and not just a commercial transaction. It's why people love Patagonia. It's why people love Lush Cosmetics and Seventh Generation and all these brands that are lead with their values. So, you know, I will admit that for many classically trained marketing and business people, it is a little counterintuitive to think that the path to building a strong and successful business is to piss some people off. That's not a bad strategy. Meaning, if you have a point of view on the world, there are going to be people who agree with you and people who disagree with you, and that's okay.
Well, what I'm hearing is that the authenticity to the mission and the idea and the values is built over time, and none of these examples that you're talking about were, oh, now we're into this specific issue that's totally disparate from where we used to be, or we are now really getting into this fight against whatever that's the newest thing. Sounds like there's sustainability over time in the message. And then also like an acceptance that if everybody likes what you're doing, you're probably not doing it right. My question for you is, whether it's at Aspen or elsewhere, there's a marketer who's going to say, no, our goal is to make this great for everybody. How do you think about that conversation as the activism guy? You're coming at it from an angle that's not necessarily on the marketing side. How do you think about those conversations, or even if you don't have to have those conversations, how do you think people in your space can navigate that?
I mean, very few companies have 98% household penetration, right? Very few brands or companies. You don't need 70% of the American population buying your product to have a hugely successful business, right? I mean, look at Patagonia. I mean, what's Patagonia's household penetration? It's not 40%, I would imagine, right? And so this idea of sort of knowing who your people are and creating, you know, again, Ben's insight that the strongest bonds you can create are with people around shared values, those are the relationships that you want to build. There's plenty of room for a company like Ben & Jerry's to continue to grow. And for people who don't like it, to buy Häagen-Dazs, you know, that's, and so you run the risk if you're inoffensive to anyone of being relevant to no one. For me, it seems pretty clear. I think the companies that do this well are the proof. Unilever owned Ben & Jerry's for 25 years, and Ben & Jerry's combined annual growth rate year over year over that 25-year period was double. And I would say because it's a better business model. It's a business model that gives a shit, that cares about what it's selling you, that cares about its supply chain, and that cares about society. You know, we were having a conversation about the Cybertruck at a retreat on a board I serve on, and the meeting was being facilitated by a person who had worked at Volvo and Polestar. Like, there is not a person in the world who doesn't know what the Cybertruck is, and everybody has an opinion. You either hate it or you love it, but everybody knows what it is. Everybody has a point of view. And as a product marketer, in many ways, that's what you want. You want your product to be talkable and relevant and top of mind and have the kind of awareness.
So I'm curious, as in all of that, you and I have talked about, and on this podcast, I've talked a lot about the idea of, you know, your brand being centered around your values and how that can create this really, really sustainable brand. And a brand, you know, not sustainable in the sustainability sense, but more in the maintainable over time, and creates relationships that are lasting and gives people a place to spend their money. Let me ask the opposite question, which is, how do you know when it's the wrong time to speak up on an issue, or what issues just don't align with who you guys are at Aspen? Climate change is a huge issue, right? There's not a single solution. There's not a single cause. There's not a single, you know, advocate or enemy. How do you guys decide when it's aligned and when you should speak up?
I think it's, again, let's go back to follow the lead of those who are on the front lines. Where are the opportunities now to advance change? We're in a very complex and complicated political environment. We're playing defense at the federal level on issues around climate change. At best, we're playing defense, but we're playing offense at the state and local level. And so I think, you know, you follow the lead of people who know what the hell they're doing. And we bring our unique toolbox to bear on that, right? And I think that's how you stay strategic. That's how you stay on target and focused in the places where you can have the most impact. I mean, I think what is unique about some of the companies we've been talking about. So I happen to know that the person who leads the advocacy work at Seventh Generation is a former Greenpeace colleague of mine. I come from Greenpeace, right? Look at Carlene Pickard, who took the Global Social Mission Director job at Ben & Jerry's, right? These are people that come out of building social movements. They are not people with MBAs and marketing degrees. And so I think that partnership between people who come from the policy and advocacy and campaigning world, partnering that skill set with classically trained marketing people is where the magic happens. I think you run the risk of being inauthentic when a marketing team hires a marketing agency to go build a purpose campaign. Like, that's inauthentic. Just today, the call before I got on with you was with the folks at Earth Justice, talking about the legal case around the endangerment finding. Like, I bet there are not a lot of corporate sustainability people that are on the phone this week with Earth Justice, right? But that's what we do. And that's what happens at Ben & Jerry's. It's what happens at Seventh Generation. We integrate ourselves into these movements, for lack of a better term. I think that's the secret to the success here. You will get criticism for doing things, but you want the people who are fighting for the things you're fighting to have your back when you're getting critiqued. Now, it's not the way it works at Aspen. It's not the way it worked at Ben & Jerry's, where a bunch of people sitting in a conference room in Burlington, Vermont are coming up with, you know, the best way to end cash bail, right? We're talking to the groups that are on the ground, that are doing the work, in saying, what can we bring to your work to make it more impactful? And I think that's how you avoid the pitfalls of either doing too many things, doing things that aren't looking strategic. I think that's the trick.
So in that vein, you know, give me a feel for how you're thinking on the measurement of the impact that you're having has evolved over the last, I don't know, 10 years or whatever, as the technology's changed, as the messaging has changed, as the environment's changed. How do you think about knowing whether success is in fact taking place or not, or whether the initiatives that you're putting in place are hitting the way you hope?
Well, I mean, ultimately, as it relates to the advocacy work, success is judged by the change we make, right? And so whether it's, you know, the work that Aspen One has done and was a part of a broad business coalition to ultimately be a part of passing the Inflation Reduction Act, the single biggest, you know, climate bill in the history of the world, or it was Ben and Jerry's helping close the workhouse jail in the city of St. Louis. Ultimately, from an impact perspective, that's what matters, right? But there are a series of tactics that ladder up to an effective strategy to win things. And that's where measurement comes in. And companies and brands are really good at doing that in a way that probably the NRDC isn't, right? Because brands have big marketing budgets and they want to spend it in a way that drives an ROI. I mean, I've seen, you know, the time that I was at Ben & Jerry's, a huge evolution in the way in which we were able to use data to drive what it was we were doing in a way that made us more effective in targeting the people we want to target, getting the people we were targeting to do the thing we wanted them to do that ultimately helped deliver on an impact strategy. But, you know, I don't pretend to be an expert there. You are. Having you and your team show up in our offices 4 times a year and provide the insights that you all provided around what was working and why it was working made our work exponentially more powerful and impactful. And so
that's the clip. That's the one we're going to clip. That's the clip for the episode. Thank you for that. That's the one.
A nonprofit is selling an idea and relevance, right? And I believe that if you show that you're effective and you're relevant, that people will support what you're doing. That's why people buy Ben & Jerry's, because Ben & Jerry's is relevant to their life. It connects with them and the things they believe, and that's why they buy Ben & Jerry's and not Häagen-Dazs. And so I am from the school of thought that sort of build it and they will come. You do good, impactful work and people will support it. The world doesn't need another organization to take your $5 a month. The world needs organizations that are focused on solving serious problems that our society and our planet face. And so I think the world would be much better off if the kinds of tools that Ben & Jerry's uses, I mean, the data that you all crunch for Ben & Jerry's, and I'm sure for many other of your clients, they aren't just focused on the advocacy, they're focused on the product side too. Right. And so,
yeah, there's an interplay that I think,
yeah,
has the success. That's where the success, the flywheel right. really starts to spin is when you right. can see one's impact on the other.
Correct.
I know you were a big part of advocating for investigating and pushing our team to identify the concept of a halo effect. So tell me what you define a halo effect as for a brand like Aspen and or Ben & Jerry's, and what does it mean for you when you walk into a meeting and you have that kind of data?
I mean, it is making the case that values drive value, that by associating your product or service with an authentic point of view on the world, you boost both, you know, you boost both things. Everything's lifted. I think early in my days at Seventh Generation, and at that time we were working on climate change. If you spend $1 marketing or advertising around climate action, that's $1 you're taking away from selling laundry yeah. detergent.
And I yeah, think there's a scarcity that I think is pretty prevalent in the marketing side of the business, right? Because for them, it is, right? It's if I spend this money here, I don't get to spend it here. And, you know, the long-term brand building that goes into it has to come from a little bit more of an abundance mindset, right? Like, hey, we think this can work for both things.
I mean, the data that we had access to at Ben & Jerry's showed during the, was it the 22 midterms, or maybe it was the 24 general election, the work that we did doing voter turnout in Georgia, which was had nothing to do with ice cream, was targeted at a specific low propensity voter, hitting them with messages from our partners that had been designed specifically to increase propensity to participate in the election. So these were issues around things like common sense gun reform, access to reproductive health services, et cetera. Those paid advertisements significantly outperformed, from a short-term sales growth, ROI perspective, an ice cream advertisement.
Yeah, so they're doing both. They are literally performing better on the front end and giving you a prospect of having long-term growth over time.
And I get, like, you know, it takes a little bit of trust that, you know, I mean, we put several million dollars into that work focused in Georgia, you know, and it takes a little bit of courage to say, okay, I'm not going to run the $3 million cookie dough campaign. We're going to go focus on turning out young, low propensity voters in Georgia. And that in doing that, there is this incredible side benefit, which is it sells even more ice cream. But if we had designed the Get Out the Vote campaign to sell ice cream, it would have failed on both fronts.
Yeah, well, I think kind of if we were to flip that the other way around, right, it is that it is expensive to say nothing, right? If you have no point of view, then your message, the way it reaches anybody, is by spending a bunch of money to get it in front of as many people as possible, because the algorithms aren't going to help you. And the world of every one of your organic followers getting every one of your messages is long gone, right? So like saying nothing, it feels like it costs nothing. And it is actually very, very expensive comparatively to saying something, you know?
Yeah. I mean, right. I mean, you know, the biggest posts, the content that created the most engagement consistently over time at Ben and Jerry's was organic, you know, values-based content. The things that have had the biggest reach ever at the company are things that were posted organically and were rooted in the company's values. I think it's a really interesting time. You know, we're seeing a little bit of kind of push and pull now at Ben and Jerry's around what the future of it's going to look like there. And I think we should all kind of be watching that.
Yeah, well, I think the other thing that jumps to me is that we've been spending a lot of time on our side, as the rest of the world has been, thinking about the impacts of what does AI mean for content and messaging and marketing as a whole. And the more and more I tie in to these conversations, the more it's clear to me that having a distinct voice is the only thing right now that AI can't replicate with pretty good amount of accuracy and efficiency, right? Like if we wanted AI to generate ads for a ski resort,
sure,
they could do it and they're going to look pretty good.
100%.
Right?
Yep.
But they're not going to be able to replace a voice that is consistent and a boldness that is core to who you guys are. And I think, you know, marketers, as they're in this space where they're sort of saying, ah, shit, like, you know, AI is going to take all our jobs. It's like, well, AI is going to take your job if you're cranking out banal, middle of the road stuff, because by definition, that's what they're going to produce, right? That's what the robots will produce. So you have to take a stance that allows you to be distinct. Otherwise, pretty quickly, a robot will do a better job. Right now, maybe it'll be 2 years from now where the robots will be better at everything. But right now, I think at least, you know, humans still are required, especially to figure out the nuance of tone and voice and message as you guys are putting that stuff out.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I think otherwise, you know, to the degree that the robots are creating everything, everything's just going to look the same. And, you know, there's no differentiation there. I mean, I think, you know, again, I think that's part of authenticity. I think, you know, our employees at Aspen One are an important part of our content. You know that so much of the content at Ben and Jerry's features like their own employees. I mean, the authenticity of that, of real people who actually have spent years and years working at the company. And I think the brands that over-index in influencers are like outsourcing authenticity. Like you, as a brand, like whether it's Aspen One or Ben and Jerry's or Seventh Generation, those platforms are influencers. And sort of thinking about using those platforms, not sort of hiring people to kind of vouch for you, but creating a platform for the brand that has a point of view and that, you know, doesn't need to rely on kind of hiring influencers in to essentially attempt to co-op authenticity, I think is.
Well, I also think too that AI doesn't necessarily, you know, so 10 years ago, it was get people to write blog posts that link back to your site, and those blog posts are the influence, and it would be impossible for a robot to write a blog post. Well, no, it turns out they can do that better than anybody could now. And I think this influencer content, the idea of like, well, they'll have to be real people. I'm like, well, are we sure about that? For how long do we think that has to be a real thing before there's totally virtual, non-existent human being,
now, right?
Like, you know, ski influencers or, you know, activism influencers, right? So having a brand where you're able to maintain that consistency of voice, I think is really unique. Let me get to some more tactical stuff quick. I'm curious for you guys at Aspen, when you walk into a meeting, a conversation with folks on your team, or you are presented some information, I'm curious how you think about the proximity versus depth. And we talk about this in terms of like reporting. You know, you and I've mentioned this Ben and Jerry's one a few times, a report that gets delivered a month, sometimes 3 weeks after the end of a quarter, because it's really in depth and it's 100 slides and infographics and super pretty and all the things. For you, if you had a choice between slightly less thorough information quicker versus, the most robust, pretty, well, data vised out report in the world with a bit of a delay, what do you think would be more useful to you?
You know, I think day to day, quicker is better. Proximity's, you know, allows you to adjust and learn kind of in real time. So I think it's still useful at whatever kind of regular interval to do a deeper dive, but maybe instead of doing 4 quarterly readouts that are super in depth, maybe you do 1 a year, 2 a year, and you lean more in the day to day on, you know, more real time, may not have to the, you know, the kind of whiz bang of, you know, the quarterly readout, but it does allow you to be more nimble and to kind of.
Yeah, well, I think it also can help feed the appetite, right, amongst your team and your organization of being able to say, like, people want to know what the results of the thing you guys said yesterday, right? That, and they'll, in a month, they'll have forgotten about the thing they said yesterday, correct, right? So there is a level of saying, hey, we're getting great coverage here, or people were pissed about this, or we're really happy with the results of this thing in real time. Yeah. And maybe that information doesn't have to be as thorough or as pretty, but I think it's still a level of, like, confidence to keep that you're on the right track. You know?
Yeah, you're on the right track. And let me just real quick, it's okay to piss people off. Like, I think that's important. Like, I would say during my time at Ben and Jerry's, the most impactful things we ever did were the things that pissed the most people off. They're the things that generated the most blowback, heat, whatever. So I think part of this is just being okay.
Yeah, but are you running around screaming that in the hallways right now at the new organization? Like, how do you think about communicating that? Because that's not a switch, right? That's a bring people along for that idea. And so how do you think about, or how
I
do
guess
you
what I'm just saying, you know, look, no, I'm not running around the C-suite at Aspen One suggesting we go piss a bunch of people off. I guess what I'm saying is that shouldn't be the defining metric for how we measure the success of something. You know, I wish it weren't true, but we live in a world where attention spans are half a second, where you have a very brief moment to stop someone's thumb. And so I do think if you're going to engage people, you got to be bold. You got to be willing to have a point of view. And it's okay, again, using Ben and Jerry's as the model. Ben and Jerry's pissed a bunch of people off over the years. That company has grown every single year it's been in business. I mean, I don't know that to be true, but almost every year, right? I mean, it may have been a little COVID hangover after everybody sat on the couch and ate ice cream for
DoorDash.
Yeah.
All right, let me hit you with some quick fires. What brand do you look up to? Let's not use Ben and Jerry's.
You know, it's a pretty small universe of companies that.
Okay, so give us one that's not Patagonia.
Yeah, I'll go with the folks at Lush Cosmetics, you know, where Carlene, the new global social mission director at Ben & Jerry's, comes from. I do admire Lush. They are another company that has, you know, a point of view not just on one thing, but on many things. They are creative in the way in which they sort of bring their values to life in the context of retail. They have a global business. And I think what these companies, 7th Gen, Ben & Jerry's, Aspen, Lush, the handful of companies that do this well, span these really broad sectors. And so it's bath bombs and it's toilet paper at 7-Gen and ice cream at Ben & Jerry's and it's skiing at Aspen One. But I think what that says is that any company can do this. You don't need to just sell ice cream to be able to do this, right? And there are companies on the other side of the political spectrum, right? Neil, you know, Chick-fil-A, Hobby Lobby, there are very successful companies that have a different set of politics. And so it shows that, you know, you can do this. You can do it, Neil.
When you think about everything in your day-to-day and your current job, what do you wish you could measure?
You know, ours is an interesting one, right? Different from a brand that's selling stuff, we're selling experiences. We're selling hotel rooms. We're selling incredible on-mountain experiences. And I think our team has access to a bunch of data. But I don't think we currently have a lot of data on how our guests that are on the mountain or in our hotels are experiencing the way in which our values are kind of showing up in their experience. Whether they're ads on the chairlift that are highlighting the cuts of the Forest Service and what that evokes for our guests who are skiing, to a QR code in the hotel room next to the light switch that highlights the fact that the utility that provides the electricity there is at 90% renewable energy in 2025. We put our sustainability report in every hotel room across all of our properties. In many ways, it's kind of the, of course, I want to know all the digital metrics and we have access to some of that, but there's this sort of in real life sort of aspect of our business that I'm sort of interested in.
I mean, I can solve your annual report one. You need to put a free drink ticket on the last page and see if anybody uses that free drink ticket. You know, it's like
good. I'm in the process of producing the next sustainability report.
That one's on me, buddy.
All right.
What podcast or book do you find yourself recommending to others most often?
So I will, you know, the podcast I consistently enjoy is Interesting Times by Ross Douthat. Is that the way you say his last name?
I don't know this one.
He's a conservative and he's super thoughtful and, you know, he has super fascinating guests, often conservative ones. It makes me think he's not a own the libs dude. He's a thoughtful conservative guy. So Interesting Times. It's a New York Times podcast. I recommend that. And then I guess I'll plug a friend's book, Annie Leonard, former executive director of Greenpeace and founder of The Story of Stuff, has a new book coming out, I think it's April 18th, on the importance of peaceful nonviolent protest in advancing social change. It's being published by Patagonia Books, and it's an awesome book. Annie Leonard and Andre Carruthers, and it's almost kind of like a coffee table-ish book. And I would plug that.
Nice. All right. And finally, the most important question we ask, if I was coming to Aspen or to Burlington, Vermont, where would you send me to get the best sandwich?
Well, I'm going to say Burlington, Vermont to start, because if I said Aspen, you'd really have to break the bank to get the sandwich. But there is a deli called Four Corners of the Earth Deli. On Pine Street in Burlington. It has probably been there for, I don't know, 15, 20 years. It's one dude who runs the place, and he makes the most incredible sandwiches that are just layered with meats and cheeses and fancy vegetables, and they're pressed sandwiches on this house-made bread. Google Four Corners of the Earth, Burlington, Vermont.
And what's your go-to order?
It's called like, I forget if it's like the, it's a country in the Middle East. It may be the Iraqi, but like it's called Four Corners of the Earth. And all of the sandwiches are inspired by different flavor profiles from cultures all around the world. It's incredible. Next time you're in Burlington, let's go to Four Corners of the Earth.
Down. Okay, so where can people look if they want to follow you and or any of this advocacy work that Aspen One is doing? Where's a good place to find out more?
you know, follow Aspen on social. At Aspen Snowmass is the handle on Instagram. You know, you can follow me on LinkedIn, although I'm not really that active on LinkedIn. No, yeah, follow us at Aspen Snowmass. Who doesn't love shots of beautiful mountains, puppies that work for the ski patrol? You know, it's a good follow.
Occasionally mixed in with some climate justice, I hope.
Some climate stuff.
Awesome. Well, Chris Miller is the Senior Vice President of Sustainability and Advocacy at Aspen One. We are psyched to have talked to you.
Thanks
man. Appreciate it.